Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is pensions and investments editor Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, interest rates hiked, inflation soaring, recession imminent. Is there any good news at the moment for struggling households? Two-year fixes have more than doubled since December. How can you find the best mortgage deals out there? Meanwhile, the housing market may look like it's still on fire, but Simon's not so sure. Also today, we talk about the gender pension gap, and Tanya gives us some tips to defend your pension from the tax man. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, we got another rate rise from the Bank of England this week, along with some pretty dire predictions about the state of the economy. The move, the sixth increase on the bounce since December, and the largest in 27 years, is in response to soaring inflation, which the bank now expects to peak at over 13%. Meanwhile, a leading think tank reckons inflation will soar to astronomical levels over the next year, forcing the Bank of England to raise interest rates higher and for longer than previously expected. RPI is predicted to reach around about 18%. And that's the measure, by the way, linked to things like rising train prices, mobile tariffs, student loan interest and car tax. Pretty gloomy stuff, Simon Lambert. Taking a look at the front pages of all the newspapers the day after the interest rate rise, and the rather gloomy predictions from the Bank of England. Firstly, the interest rate decision. Why are the Bank of England doing it? Is it necessary? Will it do what it's intended?
Well, at the expense of sounding like someone who's saying, I told you so, there were a number of people, including members of the people who regularly take part in this podcast, who had been suggesting that maybe central banks might need to start raising interest rates a little bit sooner than they were doing so, and flagging some of this inflation stuff at a point when the central banks were still maintaining that the COVID spike in inflation was transitory. I think we've moved beyond the transitory argument now. There was evidence that economies were doing much better in the face of COVID, lockdowns, disruption, etc., than it was expected they ever would do. They crashed initially when everybody was told to stay home, but people managed to stay home and still find ways of spending money. Businesses managed to find ways of selling stuff to them. If you go back even as far as the summer of 2020, first year of the pandemic, there were supply issues, but there was also an awful lot of demand. Couldn't get your hands on garden furniture, hot tubs, lots of other high-value items for love nor money. These were the canaries in the coal mine that actually the economy was doing much better than thought, and there was definitely more inflationary pressure than was expected. Then we had the rebound, energy prices spiked, oil prices spiked, Russia invaded Ukraine. All these other things have been layered on top of it. But the seeds of this were sown in the fact that interest rates were hacked all the way back to the lowest level they've been ever in this country. As we, just before, we told everybody to stay at home, to not leave their house. Okay. Hadn't done that before. Unprecedented was the word of the time. So obviously we felt, yes, that was what needed to happen. Now, arguably by the time you got to summer or autumn 2020, when people were back out there spending with gusto, I mean, look at the success of Eat Out to Help Out. They did Eat Out to Help Out to try to support the hospitality industry. You couldn't get a table. Everybody was out there eating out to help out if they weren't busy buying hot tubs and garden furniture and all those other things. At that point, you look at it and you go, we don't need to have interest rates at 0.1%, especially with all the other support we're still dishing out, like the furlough money. So what you've got is this wave of cheap money to help us out, COVID pandemic and the initial crash, slamming face first into the problem of the supply chain shortages and so on, and the issues with gas and energy prices. And now you've got central banks like the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve desperately playing catch up and trying to indicate that they are serious about getting a grip on inflation. And what's happened is the old rhetoric of supporting markets, supporting homeowners, gradual forward guidance, all that kind of stuff. But the old way of thinking has gone completely out the window, and they're just going hell for leather on raising interest rates to try and get a grip on inflation. Ironically, an inflation number that has very little to do with what raising interest rates has an effect on. The idea of raising interest rates increases the cost of borrowing, which means reduces the demand for it. Less money going into the economy from banks creating loans, whether those loans are to consumers, whether those are mortgages, whether those are to businesses and so on. And it slows everything down. And it also sends a message that says, we want to slow down the economy. We're going to try to get to the point where rates are high enough versus inflation that we get into that point of balance. Now, of course, the only problem is that with inflation this high, when you look historically, rates should be way, 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 way higher than they are now. But that would cause absolute chaos. And secondly, what on earth is raising interest rates in the UK going to do to help with energy prices that are being triggered by stuff to do with the Ukraine and Russia war and so on, and problems that Europe has with its pipeline, and that the price that Europe's paying impacts us, even though we don't import lots of that gas because it's the global price of gas and so on, and all those other things. Nothing really. But inflation is a backward-looking measure. So even if we get to that 13% in October time, that's looking back at what it was compared to a year ago. What the Bank of England's trying to do is stop more inflation after October. So it's sending a message out to the economy, businesses, consumers, everyone like that, saying, we're cracking down. We're serious on this. It doesn't want you to ask for that pay rise. It doesn't want your company to give you that pay rise. It wants your company to be worried about what's going to happen to its borrowing costs so that it won't give you that pay rise. And we're in a big, big muddle because we're coming off the back of a period where real pay has barely risen for many, many years. And then all of a sudden, people have suddenly seen inflation absolutely rocket and workers have a bit more power because many of these companies operated on the principle of the entire economy was operating on the principle there'll always be someone else to come in and do that job. And those people have just vanished as well. So we've got an issue with people as well as supplies of stuff. So we're in a bit of a pickle. And I think really central bankers are somewhat powerless to do anything about it. And they are raising rates at the same time as warning that there's going to be a recession that they are in the process of triggering.
I was going to say, and they're just pushing us into it.
Yeah. So it's a funny thing. But, you know, to draw a parallel with this kind of stuff, you've got to go back well beyond the financial world that many of us remember, unless you're older, back into the kind of situations of the 70s and early 80s. When they were desperately trying to get inflation under control. It's slightly different to the late 90s stuff. But what the impact is on normal people is that people remortgaging are going to find that their bills are going up massively at the same time as their energy bills are going up, their food bills are going up and all those other things. And it is going to hurt people.
So that's it, Tanya. I mean, how do you explain to someone the average extra payments you're going to have to make is about £650 a year, the average house, at a time when energy bills are about to, I mean, they've already skyrocketed. I don't know what else you'd say after that. They go, hang on a minute. So you're raising interest rates because you want to get us to stop spending. Who the heck is spending, Tanya, is what a lot of people will say. What you're doing is pushing us into recession, risking my job, stopping me getting a pay rise.
Well, the governor of the Bank of England's explanation for that is, if we don't do this, it could be even worse, which is a really grim message. It's a good thing he's not a politician. What Simon was saying about the signal and the indicator, and what I think we could term the sort of the psychological side of what they're doing is really important. They are not just trying to deal with what's going on at the moment and what they think is going to happen in 6 months' time. They're also trying to get the population into a kind of mindset where inflation doesn't get embedded. We don't all get big pay rises and start spending them. And businesses are a bit more careful about what they're doing. And it's a really, really tricky path. And it's really hard for them to explain that to people, mm-hmm. because I mean, people can't even get their head around the fact that they're trying to deal with the situation in November, not right now. And on top of that, they have to, you know, get their head around it could be even worse than this if we don't do this really quite bad thing now.
Isn't the problem, Simon, some of the problems with Britain, and let's talk about the economic predictions, which look pretty dire over the next year, that actually some of these issues have been around, well, for many, many years. I'm thinking low productivity, low investment. Is anything going to improve that situation?
Well, this is the difficulty. Is ideally, what we want is for businesses to invest into themselves, into their people, into their equipment, in order to increase that productivity, right? Because Britain has a productivity problem and has had a productivity problem for quite some time. We've fallen a long way behind our peers, for example, such as Germany, France. And that's happened over a period of 10 to 15 years. It's a puzzle. Nobody really knows exactly why. And one of the accusations put in it is that we'd become a low wage service economy. And in fact, actually, in part of his initial sort of Brexit leveling up disruption play, Boris Johnson said he wanted to change that. And when we had the HGV driver shortage that led to, you know, various things going on, there was talk about, well, we're just going to have to accept some disruption as we shift towards a higher wage, higher skilled economy. And to take HGV drivers, to go back, what are we talking, a year? Is it a year, I think? To go back a year. That was another canary in the coal mine of this whole stuff as well, by the way. It's like, this is, I mean, central banks should have been paying a lot more attention to things like this when they were happening. The problem is it's a bit, they don't like anecdotal stuff, which is fair enough. Us armchair anecdotalist economists and market watchers and stuff, I mean, we can say what we want. Our head isn't on the block. But there is some stuff that maybe that should pay a little bit more attention to. HGV drivers, it's a skilled job, right? They're driving a massive lorry around. They've got to pay a lot of attention, do long hours driving a lorry around. I couldn't do that. I don't know many people who could. It is actually a skill. And yet in this country, we kind of haven't really treated them very well. We haven't paid them enough. But also we haven't provided them with the facilities that they would like and they would need. If you go over to France, you will find that there are lots of places for them to stay, and they're nice. Showers, good condition, all that kind of stuff. No signs up saying stay longer than 2 hours and we'll fine you, whatever, like you get at the motorway service stations. You've got the system where they can go into a decent restaurant and get a menu routier, good food, three-course meal for a decent price, and so on. It just doesn't exist in this country to that same extent. We used to exist, but we've undermined it completely. And then all of a sudden, this pool of willing workers just started to dry up, and they were getting older. Some decided to do something else. Some people just decided that they'd rather go drive a van around for Amazon because it was less hassle and the same money, and they got treated better. But some of them went off to other countries because they came from other countries in the first place. And there was the pandemic, and they had been stopped from going home for a year and a half. And they're like, I'm going to go home. And also because they get treated better working in those other countries. And then all of a sudden, we panic. We go, whoa, hang on a minute. Where have all our HGV drivers gone? We're in a crisis. Things like that matter to productivity. Those are a bit abstract. They're away from the data and stuff like that. But it's about creating the right conditions. Now, obviously, the problem is, if you want to create the right conditions for companies to invest in their people and their environments and their equipment and their businesses and things like that, the right conditions for that don't include rapidly rising interest rates and warning of a recession. So we find ourselves probably in the position where we might set productivity back. Now, the one thing to be said is there are substantial productivity gains to be had from what has happened over the last couple of years in terms of not the shift to permanently working from home, everybody at home all the time, but the shift to a more hybrid system of working where you can better tap into the pool of people who are there by offering them that bit of flexibility. And then you can, it's easier to find that person to work for you because geography doesn't matter as much anymore. or it might matter because actually it's really good to get that. I mean, I would agree that it's great to see people. It's great to get them in and so on. I'm very much pro that, but maybe they don't need to be there all the time. So maybe you could get someone who wouldn't have otherwise come and worked for you. You can lift productivity those ways. You can less wasted hours traveling and so on. I much prefer meeting people face to face, but there's definitely some wasted time going to face-to-face meetings that aren't so important that people could potentially do over the internet, over Zoom or something like that. There's some real productivity gains to be had there. But the problem is we're too busy to think about those because we're now really worried about a recession and rising interest rates.
We've also got the rhetoric, haven't we, around that, especially from one of the Conservative leadership candidates saying that people should get back to the office, that actually, I'm not suggesting that Rishi Sunak said this, but certainly certain newspaper commentators have said it. Lazy Britain, work-shy Britain, get back. It seems that there are gains to be made in the workplace, as you said, but also investment opportunities, as long as we recognise them and take advantage of them.
Yeah, and we need to be better at taking advantage of those opportunities rather than having knee-jerk reactions to stuff, I would argue. And perhaps if we want to look at one of the countries that we've fallen behind, Germany, perhaps Germany is a little bit better at looking at the bigger picture. I think there are other countries, for example, that are also better in terms of fostering entrepreneurship and people who want to go into business through the education system. And I don't just mean people who want to start some fancy tech startup. I also mean people who just want to go work for themselves as plumbers or electricians or things like that. And we need to get a grip on all of this stuff. And I think we are yet to see a consistent strategy for doing that as a nation. Now, the only thing I would say about this rate rise scenario, recession warning and so on, is something I've said before, is that there is a cost of living crisis going on. And the real cost of living crisis is for the people who don't have any money. Their income doesn't cover their outgoings and they have no way of raising their income. They have no savings. They have no way of building up their savings, either because their income is low or perhaps because actually compared to the average, their income might be high, but they're younger. And so they don't have that savings pot to rely on. And it's very difficult to build it up. Or they're older. And they don't have income to replenish it. Pensioners on fixed incomes are going to be hit very hard by this. There is also a lot of people in the middle for whom there is talk of a cost of living crisis and who are feeling real pain at the moment every time they fill their car up, get an energy bill, or definitely if they're going to have to, you know, change their mortgage because their fixed rate deal is up, but who do have the savings and the income to rely on, but are going to have to make some different life choices in order to make ends meet. And, you know, the one I've always half jokingly referred to is the, you know, the SUV on the £800 a month PCP deal. But there is an element of seriousness within there. But it's also worth noting that when people have to make those choices, when they have to give up their car or, you know, get trade down to a cheaper secondhand one, or they have to stop going out for dinner, you know, once a month, or they have to not take one of their holidays a year, or the alternative is they can't save money every month like they used to be able to. They can just make it balance at the end of the month. That lowers their quality of life. That is a lowering of our general quality of living. So we are getting poorer. You might not, people feel like they're getting poorer, but that, you know, they might technically still be relatively wealthy, those people, but they are having a poorer quality of life. And that's how inflation and recession and those things affect us. They affect different people in different ways. And some people are really, really going to struggle, and we really need to help those people. There's other people higher up who are, some of them, calling for help for them, who probably will just need to actually rely on themselves, but for whom it is going to reduce their quality of living.
Yeah. Tanya, Simon makes a good point there. This is going to impact people differently. I was asked today on radio, like, how bad is this going to get? And all I could say is, well, for some people, it's already horrendous and it's going to get a lot worse. And for some people, it's going to sting. There are very few people who are not going to be impacted by this. Is there a point now where we seriously look at different measures to help people? A £400 off your energy bills for everyone, is that appropriate? Is it enough? Do we need more targeted support? Do we need to put pressure on the energy companies for a PR purpose? Could they not do something more? What needs to happen, Tanya?
Well, they're having a big discussion about this at the moment, aren't they, in the Tory leadership contest. The reality is that the new energy bill price hike is coming, the end of August. And I think that's going to really concentrate minds. Whoever wins is going to have to do a second cost of living package. We've had one. They're only about halfway through the first one with all these payments direct to people, especially vulnerable people. And they were trying to address, I suppose, the people for whom it's really going to hurt with that. Very laudably, but it's clear that it's not going to be enough. And I really think that the first thing they're going to have to do is come up with another one super fast. Ironically, what they're arguing about is income tax cuts, which would benefit people who are better off. The people that, as you said, it's going to sting, or as Simon said, their standard of living is going to suffer, but they're going to get by. And I think there needs to be a switch of priorities between those two things. And I think it will happen. I think that they'll be forced to. Mm-hmm. I think as soon as we've got a new leader, there'll be much less talk of immediate income tax cuts and much more pressure on coming up with a package to address the emergency now, because there are people who literally can't pay the bills. There's absolutely no way they can pay an energy bill. And it's not going to be freezing or starving. It's going to be both this winter. I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's what it is. Obviously, we got the predictions from the Bank of England, but every time they come back to the table, as it were, we get an even worse prediction, particularly when it comes to inflation. How bad do you see this going? And I'm thinking now there was some research out this week talking about RPI could reach 18%. Of course, RPI is what you link to things like train prices, mobile tariffs, student loan interest, car tax, all sorts of things that, you know, come April next year, I assume. Is it April next year when they start to go up again? We're going to have another massive hit. This is going on and on, isn't it?
Yeah, RPI is significantly higher than CPI. Well, the reason that we've stuck around with RPI is it's written into a lot of contracts, RPI, so it's difficult to unravel it. And also, I'm going to be cynical here and say it is attached to all of those things that the government likes to put up every year, including the train fares, the student loans, all the rest of it. And they don't necessarily want to give up on that. However, when they want to sort of talk about the rate of inflation, they like to talk about CPI, which is much lower. And actually, the favoured one now is CPIH, which includes housing costs, which is a few percentage points lower than CPI, the headline one, which is 9.4 in June.
Time to scrap it?
Well, for the reasons I've said, there's one good reason for keeping it, which is it's written into lots of contracts, and one bad reason for keeping it, which is it really helps the government in all sorts of ways.
Simon, you were shaking your head just then. What was that about?
I don't think train fares, well, I hope so. I seriously don't think they're going to use that RPI figure for train fares and stuff like that. They can't do that. It would just be insanity.
Before, did they?
No. And actually, if you're talking about things like wage price spirals and stuff like that, that helps trigger the wage price spiral. And the concern about the wage price spiral, which is...
Explain that, Simon, the economic term.
The wage price spiral is something from our economic textbooks, right? Which actually you might have thought was one of those things from your economic textbooks that was taught to you with this is how the theory works. But of course, in real life, it doesn't work like this, because most people would need to have very, very long memories to recall anything that involves wages and spiraling within the same sentence. But the wage price spiral, the idea is that effectively you get inflation and it becomes self-feeding, because workers ask for more money in order to cover inflation. Companies feel that they have to pay them, or organizations feel that they have to pay them this money, but they then subsequently have to put their prices up in order to get the money in to pay people, who then have to ask for more money, and the companies then give it to them and then have to put their prices up. You see where the spiral element comes in. That's the most basic version of this argument. And you could see how if people's season tickets suddenly went up by nearly 20%, that would give them a great deal of extra impetus to go in and say to their employer, you're going to have to pay me more because it's costing me a lot more to get here, kind of thing. Now, whether that work or not, we don't know, but it depends how much bargaining power you have. Workers haven't had a huge amount of bargaining power in in recent years, but they seem to be flexing their muscles somewhat. Certainly unionized workers are flexing their muscles at the moment. We were discussing before we started about the difficulty of getting places on trains at the moment. And I think probably you're maybe going to start to see that in the private sector, where you don't have the unionized element, but we've got still got quite a strong jobs market. So you've got the, well, I'll jump ship to somewhere else argument going on. Having said that, there is a very good economic argument for not raising wages at the rate of inflation when you have inflation running as hot as it is now. And that is the whole wage price spiral argument.
It's that wage price spiral that the Bank of England is really trying to address with this, with its interest rate move as well. It can't do anything really about the external shocks, but it can bear down on this bit of it, I think.
I think the really difficult thing, though, is that is actually then when people look at this individually, they go, well, hang on, X company is making X amount of profits. So why don't they take some of those profits and give some of those to their workers? Especially if that company has shareholders, for example, who it's paying out big dividends to. People will say, well, why are you paying out like this massive dividend to all these people who've bought shares when you could give some of that money to the workers? And then they look at the CEO's salary and they look at the salary of the people in the C-suite and they go, hang on, these guys are getting, and these guys are women sometimes, tends to mainly be men, they're taking home millions of pounds a year and I'm on 35 grand and struggling. This isn't fair. Why can't you afford to give me a pay rise if you can pay yourself £4 million? And I think the pendulum swings, and the pendulum has swung very far towards the corporate earnings side, going to shareholders and to the top brass over the past 10, 20 years. And I think we're probably seeing the pendulum swing back the other way at the moment. Unfortunately, it's feeding right into that wage price spiral thing that we've just been talking about.
But that very thing you've been talking about, the business investment side of it, the share buybacks and the big dividends and the high salaries for the people right at the top of companies, that has actually been, you know, starving out the business investment side of it as well. And actually, it could help the productivity side if there was more encouragement to do less of that and actually try and make their businesses more efficient as well. Quite aside from the issue with wages.
I would 100% agree with Tanya there. And if just in case anybody thinks we've gone down some kind of weird socialist rabbit hole here, and I'm about to put my Wolfie Smith hat on and start shouting freedom for tooting, there's a very strong capitalist argument for this stuff, which goes back to what we were talking about with the productivity thing, is that the best form of capitalism is the one that tries to enrich the most people, not just enrich a small slice of people at the expense of a lot of people doing the work. And that's not socialism, that's proper capitalism.
Isn't the point that we've seen these huge rises in wages, particularly for CEOs and the C-suite, but we've sort of accepted it because to a degree the wealth has been filtering down and it's okay in good times, but these ain't good times. You know, when you have massive profits and CEO pay and shareholder payouts at companies which are responsible for heating homes, people eating, essentially could be deaths. There's something a little bit different here, no?
Yeah, and some of those businesses will defend themselves on the fact that they're not making profits off the back of people's heating. British Gas did this. British Gas said, we aren't making a profit on the bit where we sell you gas and electricity. Centrica, the owner of British Gas, said, we're not making a profit on that bit. In fact, it's making a loss. It's making a profit on the energy prices stuff, the global energy market. But you can't detach the price that we're paying for our gas and electricity from the global energy market. The reason why we're paying so much money for it is to do with the global energy market. The same thing with Shell and BP, for example. You know, they're making huge amounts of money from the global energy market. They're not necessarily making money from the fact that that petrol's really expensive in this country. But they are UK-based global companies, so we take pot shots at their bosses and their chief executives and the amount of dividends that they're paying out to shareholders. But it is worth remembering, of course, that those dividends going to shareholders are enriching all of us, because they are what helps our pensions to grow. They're what helps our investments to grow. If you're a pensioner and you've got your money still invested in retirement, and you rely on that to provide an income, then a lot of that will be coming from dividends. And these are the companies that are the biggest dividend payers in the UK stock market. If you've got your money invested in a pension that's growing for your retirement, probably likely to be invested some of it in the UK stock market. Dividends, as we've talked about on this podcast before, are the greatest source of long-term investment returns. So it is going towards helping you get a bit richer. It just often doesn't feel like that when it actually represents a very small amount going towards you getting a lot richer, whereas you see the company profits and they're a very, very large amount, and the CEO pay of a Centrica or a BP or a Shell or a whatever company that has a consumer facing business that is putting its prices up and you take a pot shot at.
This is a whole episode in itself, I'm sure. But let's move on, because we've discussed the big economic picture. I want to drill down, Tanya, into, you know, how is all of this going to impact me and my finances and the interest rate rise? Savings we're seeing edge up, those slowly bad at the high street banks, typically shop around challenger banks. Mortgages, you're going to have a bit of a shock if you're coming off a fix, because we've seen mortgage rates double since last autumn. Not so, of course, with savings. What is it like in the mortgage market, Tanya?
It's looking grim for people who are on fixed deals and are coming up to having to remortgage. The very standard £150,000 mortgage, which is on a two-year fix. We were looking at a rate of 1.3% at the beginning of the year. Now, according to the latest figures from the stories we're running on This Is Money, 3.46%. So that is a really big jump, and it translates to about £159 extra. This is obviously the standard version. When it comes to what's going on with the other rates at the moment, the standard variable rate, which apparently about 12% of the population are on for various reasons, is 5.17%. The 5-year is 4.08%, 10-year 4.19%. So that is what you're looking at. And people are going to have some tough decisions to make, even if they're not affected straight away.
The rates are really close, actually, listening to Tanya there, the 2, the 5, the 10 even, you know, they're not a million miles apart, are they, Simon? So is it worth fixing for longer? Do you go for 2 years and hope the storm will have passed by then? I mean, what do you do?
The reason why there's not that much gap in rates is because rates are rising rapidly, in case anybody hadn't noticed that. If you've got this far in the podcast and not realized that interest rates are rising rapidly, well done, I must say. But then there's expected to be a recession. If you've got this far in the podcast and didn't realize there's expected to be a recession, well done again, I would say. That is then going to trigger, it's expected, rates to come down again. There's a curve that goes up and there's a curve that comes down. Your 2 and your 5-year sit either side roughly of the peak of that curve. I would always say that it's worth considering fixing for 5 years if you don't think you're going to be moving anywhere. 2 years passes very quickly. I've moved into my house 2 years ago. I can't believe it's been 2 years. If you can fix for 5 for the same as 2, then that's just starts to make it a longevity question. Maybe 10 is a good option, but you need to really think about whether you are likely to move and whether you can take that mortgage with you. And the difficulty is when you move, you can take a mortgage with you, but if you need to borrow more money, it can make things slightly complicated. The lender needs to assess your new property versus it. But I mean, in many cases, if people do move with their existing mortgage, it's not impossible. It gets to, you talk about all the obstacles, but people do it all the time. I would definitely consider the 5-year. I think one of the things that's worth noting on this is that for people who've got big-ish mortgages in a large chunk of the country, i.e. you've got a £250,000 mortgage, you've got 20 years left, the difference between the 1.3% rate on average at the turn of the year and the 3.5% rate that you might be paying now, might be having to remortgage to now, is £267 a month. That's quite a lot of money. And then when you add that to maybe paying in that house, you might be paying an extra £150 a month for your energy bills. And then you may be paying an extra £50 on food and petrol compared to what you were. You suddenly find that you're getting about £470 a month more coming out So you could probably round that up to 500. Chuck an extra 30 on for all the other stuff that's gone up. As we talked about before, for those people who aren't in the heating versus eating thing, but are in the comfortably off scenario, most of them don't have a spare £500 a month. And this is where the impact is really going to be felt. But also, I mean, one of the problems is that if rates stay this much higher, it'll cost you a lot more in interest over the life of the mortgage. So the difference between paying a 1.3% rate and a 3.5% rate on that 20 years left for the 250 grand mortgage is a total interest charge on the 1.3% for the rest of the mortgage. And that was if it stayed at that for the rest of the mortgage. I mean, nobody knows whether that's going to happen, but would be an interest charge of £34,000 versus at the 3.5% average over those 20 years, an interest charge of £98,000. There's quite a big difference between those two numbers. Who wins there? The bank.
Can I put a word in for two-year fixes? Simon and I have had this conversation quite a few times on this podcast, but it's really hard to see very far ahead. No one can see 5 years ahead, and it's actually impossible to see 2 years ahead in terms of what might happen economically. It is very possible that the Bank of England will overshoot, put us in recession. Inflation will start shaking out sometime next year, and they're going to have to put interest rates down again, in which case you might have got your five-year fix in, and we could be sitting here at this time next year and the Bank of England will be sharply reducing rates again. So because I don't know what's going to happen, and I'm willing to admit that, I prefer to stick with the two-year fix because it just gives me more flexibility.
What about, Simon, if house prices fall and you're on a two-year fix? Will you struggle at the end of it potentially?
Well, people have got used to house prices going up and it helps increase the equity in their home. And so they step down a mortgage level each time. And so if house prices do fall, then yes, that would be a problem. And certainly I think maybe if you're someone who's buying with a 5% or 10% deposit mortgage, and you would be most impacted by suddenly seeing your monthly payments dramatically rise, or potentially if house prices do fall, you might struggle to then remortgage because you could find yourself in that dreaded negative equity word, then certainly something like the five-year fix is very much worth considering because it buys you that extra bit of time. And I would say to anybody who is considering buying in that scenario, and actually anybody who's considering buying in really any scenario, if you're buying a home, make sure that you would think you will be happy to continue living in that property for the next 5 years. We always talk about investing being a long-term gain, and you should only invest over a five-year or longer period. I'm a firm believer that unless there are big extenuating circumstances and you're an outlier to most people, that you should probably try to buy a home over at least thinking ahead for at least a 5 to 10 year period on that one as well, because you never know what's going to happen, as Tanya said, and you might get stuck in that property and not be able to move. And so, it's really awkward if you're stuck in a property that's fundamentally unsuited to you.
So I'm talking about the housing market, your piece this week. Prices look like they're still soaring despite rate rises, but to take the market's temperature, look at what's not selling. Explain.
Well, I talked about us armchair anecdotalists, economists and market watchers earlier, didn't I? Well, here's a bit of armchair anecdotalist market watching. House prices still going up at an extremely rapid rate. Nationwide said this week that property inflation 11% in the year to July. Halifax said today, as we're recording this podcast, that house price inflation has actually come down slightly. It's eased to 11.8% in July compared to 12.5% in June. Whichever one of those numbers you want to pick, and I know that Georgie Frost is a massive fan of the house price reports that all have differing numbers scenario. Whichever number you want to pick, it's a big number, right? It's even higher than that inflation that we're freaking out about at the moment. But is the market still as red hot as you think? As I said, if you're an armchair anecdotalist market watcher, you don't have to just rely on the prices of properties that are selling like the major house price reports do, or the mortgage completions, or the asking prices of properties newly coming to market. You can watch the stuff that isn't selling. And I think that gives you a better clue to the housing market maybe than the stuff that's selling. So here you go. If you are a regular Rightmove watcher and you watch your local area, and realistically, it's your local area that matters more to you than anywhere else, because if you're, for most people, when they move, they're most likely to move within their local area. Or if it's, you're not likely to move in your local area, watch the other area. It's very easy to do, thanks to the benefit of the internet. You see what's coming onto the market, you see how much it's going on for, and then you can see whether it goes under offer. And if you watch this stuff, you start to be able to take the temperature of the market. When things just keep coming on for more than this last similar house, more and more and more, and you look at it, you go, that is a crazy price. And yet somehow the stuff is still going under offer. You know that market is red hot. That is where we were, certainly where I live, maybe a year ago, right? Then you've got the stuff comes on for a bit more each time, and you think, how much? And a fair bit of it still goes under offer. Okay. And you think, oh, okay, well, and that's when the market is still pretty hot, but maybe not as red hot as before. But then you've got the stuff starts to come on for those high prices, and then it sticks around and it doesn't sell. And that's when you realize that the market is starting to cool. And then you start seeing the reduced labels coming up on Rightmove. And when property prices are reduced, it does say that it is being reduced. Now, it doesn't tell you how much it's been reduced, obviously. There are some little plugins that you can do. I can't remember the name of it. There's a Chrome plugin that you can do that helps you track this. Estate agents can play a bit of a game where they relist a property or whatever. They're not meant to do that. But that's when you start to see that definitely the market is coming off the boil. And then at the lowest end of it, you've got the whole thing where properties come onto the market and you think that actually they look reasonably decent value and they're still not selling. That is when you know that the market is absolutely in the toilet. So there you go. Watch what's not selling as well as what is. And that's how to take the temperature of the property market, in my view.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by eToro's Ben Laidler to discuss what's been going on the markets. Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, another busy week. What have we had going on?
Well, I guess this global market rally has just continued. US equity markets are now up over 10% off their lows, and crypto assets have actually been leading all asset classes and are up closer to 30%. What's been driving this? Sharply lower oil prices sort of fanned hopes that we might get a decline in inflation and an end to all these interest rate hikes that we've been seeing. And company profits in the middle of second quarter earnings are definitely coming in sort of better than feared and easing some of these recession concerns.
And we've also been looking at some of the forward guidance that these companies have been bringing out along with their earnings. And how's that looked?
Well, it's not great, but again, expectations are even worse. And you know, this is all about sort of beating low expectations. So we've been jumping over this sort of low bar, and given how concerned we've all been about profits, about this looming recession, it's actually been a sort of relative good news story.
So we're into the second week of August next week. What do we have to look forward to on the markets? Will it be a quieter one?
So it is a little bit of a quiet week, but we do have the US inflation report, which I think is going to be the big, big focus, given that inflation is just driving everything right now. And, you know, fingers crossed, this might be the peak. So we're looking for a small decline to under 9%, which I think if you saw, markets would take well. We've also, closer to home, got the second quarter GDP report in the UK, which will likely slip into the negative territory, unfortunately, and just comes after a very depressing outlook from the Bank of England last week, looking for 13% inflation and a long recession. So that's not a good news story, but we're going to get a bit more information on that.
Okay, Ben, thank you very much for the update and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Let's talk about the gender pension gap. Now, regardless of the sector that you work in, women's pensions are outstripped by men's in every single one in the UK as they reach retirement. Some of the worst gaps are in the top industries for female employment. Now, the average pension fund of women aged 55 plus is 12,000, less than half the size of men's, which averages 26,000. That's according to Legal and General. Tanya, our pensions guru. We'll get into the gender pension gap, but these figures seem really low. Just explain That's not what people are retiring on, right? It's just...
No, this is the workplace pots of people who are in Legal and General schemes.
Right.
And we're not talking about their, you know, their SIP business, people with private pensions. We're talking about the workplace pots. So they might have lots of other pots from lots of other companies they work for and other sources of income as well. But they've analysed millions of pots, which is why they've managed to go across every industry sector. And therefore, the very scale of the research means this is an interesting finding.
Why do we have a gender pension gap?
There are two really big reasons, and there's plenty of reasons, but the two main ones are women get paid less so they can save less into their pensions, and they do unpaid caring work. And I'm not just talking about stopping to have children. When parents get elderly and someone needs to look after them full time, it is nearly always the female family members who are expected to stop work and do that. As a result of that, their pensions get misaligned with men's from fairly early age. The research shows that until women start having children, they're pretty much on a par. Their pay doesn't start really diverging. And obviously, once a break starts coming in, you know, when you start taking breaks for maternity leave, that is when holes start appearing as well. And it's very difficult to make them up once they start. We did an Ask an Expert piece recently explaining exactly how you can prevent this, somebody going on maternity leave. How do you prevent that happening to you? And there is a way to do it. You have to be really on the ball. You can put more into your pension before or after, but you can do the numbers and make sure that you don't fall behind when you're on maternity leave. But you have to have the will to do it, and also obviously the money to do it. One of the things I've said in the past with this is that if you're in a couple, it is a very good approach to have a joint strategy towards your pensions. It benefits you both in the end if both pensions are maxed out, certainly that you're taking advantage of all the matching contributions, the free money that employers give you for increasing your contributions a bit, they'll throw more in. Now, if one member of the couple is doing that and the other isn't, then you really should be thinking about subsidising the lower paid one in order to bump that up. If you end up splitting up and you have to split the pensions, two much better balanced pensions, fully contributed to, are much easier to split with a lot less hostility than if they are wildly mismatched.
Indeed. More about this research, though. I'm curious, where are the worst industries? Who are the worst offenders?
The three worst are healthcare, pharmaceuticals, and social care.
Areas where there's a lot of female employment.
Yes, healthcare and social care particularly. I would think that this is probably down to one of the aspects of women getting paid less, which is that men tend to take senior jobs. And I think that in healthcare and social care, at the top end, the highest paid jobs are mostly done by men. And then there is a huge gap between their pay and the pay of the lowest paid, which are predominantly women. So you've got predominantly men at the really high paid end of those industries and predominantly women at the very low paid end of the industries. Now, that's my theory on why those particular industries might be particularly badly affected by this.
And the best?
The best is couriers and transportation.
There you go. It's interesting. Tanya, we're not done with pensions yet because no one wants to save up all their working life for a decent retirement only to get hit by the tax man. So you've asked the experts, you're an expert yourself, what are the tax traps when it comes to pensions and how can you avoid them?
Well, there are unfortunately a lot of tax traps when it comes to pensions, particularly when you reach retirement age. And I won't list them all, but I will say that some of them, they're the kind of traps that if you don't know about them, you can fall into them, and you don't know about them unless you are either told about them or you really do a lot of research or you have an advisor to help you. It's very, very easy not to know about these. Most people don't. There's an emergency tax trap that can actually be fixed. It's where the tax man, when you take your very first withdrawal, when you first retire, they assume you're going to take 12 monthly payments of the same size and they tax you accordingly. And you can get it back, but you have to fill in a form or wait for the tax man to sort it out. At least that one's fixable. One that's much more serious is something called the money purchase annual allowance, which is a horrible bit of jargon for what happens when you start making withdrawals above and beyond your 25% tax-free lump sum. When you start taking any taxable income above that, then you can no longer save up to, you know, 40,000 a year into a pension and get tax relief. You can only put 4,000 a year, an absolutely dramatic drop. And if you're the kind of person who's half retired, may get another job again, stop for a bit, but you might have an option of starting work again, then that ability not to get the tax relief from the government is a really serious matter, and it's irreversible. Once you've done it, there's no going back. One of the most straightforward ones really is income tax. And people do fall into this trap. They know that at 55, they could take all their pension if they want. Most people are warned by the pension companies or the Pension Wise free service, guidance service, not to do this. So hopefully few people fall into this, but you can easily get pushed from the basic rate tax band into a higher rate one just because you've taken huge sums you very probably don't need out of your pension. And this actually stops people doing what might seem quite sensible things, like paying off their mortgage, because you can do it, but you have to assess it very carefully, because if you're going to have a massive tax bill for doing that, then maybe it'll wipe out the benefits of getting short of your mortgage at the point that you retire. You really have to do your sums on that one.
All right then. Tanya, thank you so much. Simon, thank you. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past. And I have been remiss to mention up until this point, obviously, there is good news here for savers in terms of rising interest rates and savings accounts are going up. If you want to, don't accept your bank's insult account. Some of them are still paying people 0.1% or very low rates like that. Go to thisismoney.co.uk/save, where you will find our independent best buy tables. They will tell you what the best savings accounts are. Move your money. Rates are going up. You won't match inflation, but you won't lose as much money. And if you want to know, have an informed sort of knowledge of how much your mortgage rate might go up to, thisismoney.co.uk/mortgage-finder. Put in your house value, put in your mortgage amount, and you will see how much a mortgage would cost you now. Forearmed is forewarned, or forewarned is forearmed. Whichever way around that is, just do
it. Either way, yeah. Thank you, Simon. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.